He kōna e purangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
This is Media Watch. I'm Colin Peacock. Last week on the program, we heard how news organisations around the Asia Pacific are embracing AI to enhance their journalism, and how AI-driven fake news is also giving them a real headache, something that we might have to get ready for in the future in our media here as well. This week, we talked to a couple of editors, one in Hong Kong and one in the Philippines, where the threats to media freedom are much more acute. We'll also catch up with the ongoing argument about advocacy advertising in our newspapers, which hasn't exactly been resolved to everybody's satisfaction.
What a pathetic organisation in every commercial relationship, and a few wokesters jump up and down.
But first, everyone usually agrees that holding powerful politicians to account is a key job of our news media. Good democracy, they say, depends upon it from our fourth estate. But this week we look at some cases of that where the media didn't exactly get universal thanks later.
For years, New Zealand has benefited from a reputation for having low levels of corruption compared to most other countries. But a new report suggests we are at risk of complacency, and significant changes are needed to tighten up rules around lobbying, political donations and official information. Philippa Yazbek has produced the report for the Helen Clark Foundation and is with us this morning. Kia ora.
Kia ora, Jack.
That was TVNZ's Jack Tame on the Q&A show last weekend, and the report's author, Philippa Yazbek, went on to tell him we have a she'll-be-right attitude towards those things here in New Zealand, including this.
Ministers or their staff leave Parliament, go set up and start lobbying their former colleagues on behalf of private sector clients, sometimes they go back into the beehive. We're also seeing decisions that seem to be unduly influenced by interest groups, where politicians are making very unpopular decisions that seem to be detrimental to most people.
And there had already been an example of the door revolving the other way, a lobbyist becoming a minister in that same edition of the Q&A show just before that. More about that in a minute. But this week, Sir Peter Gluckman, in his capacity as director of the University of Auckland's Centre for Informed Futures, COI2, said in a statement welcoming that Helen Clark Foundation report,
"The idea that you finish up in Parliament on Friday and start lobbying on Monday is unacceptable. And I think most people would acknowledge that."
And former Attorney General Chris Finlayson was one of them. He told Newstalk ZB's Francesca Radkin he also believes there should be a stand-down period for lobbying.
Hey, how important is the discussion this report has raised?
Oh, I think it's a very, very useful discussion. As I said in my introduction, it's non-party political, so the fact it was published by the Helen Clark Foundation doesn't mean it's necessarily left-wing. But it does raise important issues, for example, the Official Information Act and compliance with it, and whether we need a tougher regime.
But Bryce Edwards, director of Victoria University of Wellington's Critical Politics Project, said today's politicians wouldn't be so enthusiastic about that new report. For that reason, he reckoned the Helen Clark Foundation had bent over backwards not to offend the politicians in its report. The Shining a Light report then went on to cite Bryce Edwards himself as saying politicians and civil servants are now more adept at managing and working with the media. And the report said observers now complain of politicians who robotically repeat talking points rather than answering direct questions. But when it comes to holding ministers to account for the bold claims they make and setting the record straight, well, the media can still shine a lot of light on that. Though, as Hayden Donnell now reports, they haven't always been praised for it lately.
How much has been spent on the registry?
Over $200 million has been put aside for spending on the registry.
How much has been spent on the registry so far?
I'm not aware of how much has been spent, but $208 million has been put aside.
It's public information. So it's cost $10 million to establish the firearms registry. And this is from the authority. We estimate it'll cost $8.5 million per annum to continue operating.
And
seems like good value for money, really.
No, I don't think it is.
That's Jack Tame arriving fully armed with a high-capacity magazine of facts to interview Associate Justice Minister Nicole McKee about a potential loosening of our gun laws. The statistical bait and switch has become a signature move for the Q&A presenter, especially when interviewing politicians. Here he is with then-aspiring Finance Minister Nicola Willis last year.
I'm just doing the maths, OK? So, in 2018, before the foreign buyer ban was lifted, how many purchases, as a percentage of overall purchases in New Zealand, did foreign buyers represent?
I don't have that number right now.
OK, I do. It's 3%, right?
And here's an exchange with New Zealand First Leader Winston Peters from around the same time.
Ask yourself how many gang members are in prison now.
I'm asking you, how many gang members are there in prison now?
Well, it depends what where you talk about. Are they
How many gang-affiliated prisoners are there in New Zealand prisons, according to Corrections Now?
No one has that record.
Oh, Corrections does. 2,700.
McKee's interview was distinguished by having not one but two of these instant fact checks. When she said she'd lobbied to close a loophole which the Christchurch mosque shooter utilised to modify a legally bought gun into a military-style assault rifle, Tame said he'd trawled Facebook for evidence she'd worked to defeat a recommendation that may have done just that.
So you say that when you lobbied the minister at the time, that you argued to close that loophole?
Definitely.
OK, and so I why did you release this video?
Since 2012.
Shortly after you lobbied the minister, you made a post on the Colfo Facebook page. We've got a video of it here. Here's what you had to say.
Hi everyone, my name is Nicole McKee and I really, really like guns. Wanted to give you a bit of an update about a meeting that Jeff Thomas and I had with the Minister of Police, Paula Bennett, this afternoon. So just wanted to let you know that a lot of the concerns on some of those really controversial recommendations are likely to be gone.
McKee insists she did campaign against that loophole. She just thought the proposals at the time risked putting too many restrictions on legal and responsible gun owners. But it was definitely a bruising encounter. Afterwards, she retreated into a safe space, Leah Panapa's show on The Platform.
I believe in allowing the person to answer questions without being railroaded or accused of something as odious as what happened in Christchurch, because those accusations can lead to someone believing that. So to let the minister finish her questions and explain a few issues, please welcome Associate Justice Minister Nicole McKee. Nicole, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Leah. Thank you for the opportunity to have a grown-up discussion.
That grown-up discussion was followed by Panapa encouraging her listeners to complain about Q&A to the Broadcasting Standards Authority.
Yeah, just go into the BSA page, Broadcasting Standards Authority, and they give you, you can pick, was it broadcast on radio, TV, other forms, mm-hmm. You know, trust me, uh-huh. in the past, I've been there.
I actually think he may be made to apologise for that. I think it was well over the top.
Panapa's main complaint was that Tame was unfair to McKee. Others have called him biased. Those allegations would be more convincing if Tame didn't regularly harvest the political hides of left-wing MPs as well. This is his Homeric epic of a question to Labor leader Chris Hipkins in the run-up to last year's election.
Labor came to power 6 years ago, promising to tackle the housing crisis. Mm. Kiwi Build, we all agree, was a disaster. Houses today are more expensive relative to incomes in New Zealand than they were when you took over. And before we blame COVID, they were also more expensive relative to incomes before the COVID property boom. You promised to tackle the mental health crisis. The head of the Mental Health Foundation said this at the end of last year, quote, "The transformation of mental health is failing. Things are overall getting worse, not better." And climate change. The light rail you promised would be in Mount Roskill 2 years ago still doesn't have a single inch of track. Agriculture still isn't paying for its emissions. And as Prime Minister, your first action was to reinstate a tax cut for fossil fuels. Your last was to oversee a $236 million raid on the climate fund. You have had 6 years in government. You've lost numerous cabinet members to scandal and incompetence. And when we consider that record heading into the campaign, why should anyone think a future Labor government has the capacity to deliver on its promises?
Well, I'm sure you'll let me go through each of those one at a time now, Jack. Thank you.
If Tame is guilty of something, it's not bias and more a severe allergy to obfuscation, evasion and spin, and that's probably a good condition to have as a journalist. Not everyone seems to have the same aversion. Case in point, this is how just about every media outlet reported a recent road safety announcement from Transport Minister Simeon Brown.
The government's confirmed it's setting aside $1.3 billion over the next 3 years to crack down on high-risk behaviours, focusing on drunk and drug driving.
That was one news, but the New Zealand Herald, RNZ, the ODT, Newstalk ZB and others also got crackdown fever. On the face of it, there's no problem. That's accurate. Money has been assigned to combating impaired driving. Dig a little deeper than the press release, though, and you'll find the actual road policing budget has been cut back from what it was over the last 3 years. The main change is some of it's being earmarked specifically for targeting drunk and or high drivers. Earlier this year, he announced what many outlets described as a $500 million pothole repair fund. Again, on the face of it, totally accurate. But as it turns out, the cash for the new pothole fund came from zeroing out the old road maintenance fund, which was used in large part for, you guessed it, fixing potholes. The actual budget increase for fixing the roads was relatively minimal. At least one outlet resisted the intoxicating allure of a crackdown-infused headline, though. The Greater Auckland blog titled its piece on the government's latest transport announcement, Road Policing Reduction. Its director, Matt Lowry, says our news organisations may have missed a trick here.
It's being presented as a brand new package of all this new funding that's coming in, and we've seen the same thing with the pothole fund. These numbers are freely available on various websites, including the NZTA and from budget documents, and they show that this is a reduction in spending.
You kind of can't blame the minister for trying to put the best foot forward, but it's sort of more of a media failure, isn't it? Things aren't going up with the appropriate scrutiny.
Yeah, absolutely. We need and deserve a better outcome there. Road safety is in particular, is a really critical issue in New Zealand. We have much higher deaths and serious injuries than most of our peer countries. And if we're seeing the government reduce funding, then we should have that reported. And it's the same thing we see with the budget, where the budget comes out and governments present this, oh, look at all this new spending, but a lot of it is just stuff that was already announced or continuation of an existing program rather than anything particularly new, but it's just because it needs to be reauthorised every 3 years or something like that. There absolutely needs to be a step in the process to check and make sure that presented as something new, that it actually is something new or that it's not hiding something else. We've seen this with previous governments as well. Because, money doesn't just come from nowhere.
That was Matt Lowry from Greater Auckland. Brown isn't the only politician benefiting from our media's sometimes less than forensic analysis of their announcements and assertions. Chris Luxon recently told journalists in Australia that 88% of Māori children in Year 8 can't read. As it turns out, he got his numbers mixed up, conflating maths and reading achievement rates. His error didn't get coverage until days later, after it was debunked on Reddit. Just a mistake, but probably one the media should have picked up on, just as they did with Luxon's equally erroneous claim that 4,100 more phone case managers and 2,100 more community job counsellors are set to be employed by the Ministry of Social Development. Some potentially iffy political claims are more serious.
Since we've come into office in November 2023, the number of households in whānau living in emergency housing has gone down by one-third. And over 1,000 tamariki have moved from emergency housing into a different form of housing, a better form of housing.
That was Associate Housing Minister Tama Pōtaka delivering some good news on emergency housing numbers. He got the desired headline from the Waikato Times and other stuffed papers, which ran with 1,000 fewer children in emergency accommodation, Associate Housing Minister reveals. But in the story, Pōtaka stops short of saying all those children are actually in a better form of housing, instead telling the paper 300 are in private accommodation and 500 in some form of social housing. That raises questions, chief among them, what about the other 200 children? The Waikato Times didn't say. Other media treated the stats a little more sceptically, with the Herald writing an editorial questioning whether some of the reduction was actually down to the government making emergency housing harder to access, and Ryan Bridge casting a doubtful eye on the figures on Newstalk ZB.
They said they'd used, quote, intensive work to cut the numbers. I don't know whether I'm just cynical, but do you believe that? Or do you think there's some fudging of the numbers here.
But it took a week for another stuffed journalist to make the obvious inquiry.
Have all of those children moved into housing? Are you worried that some are now homeless?
No, I'm not worried that some are now homeless, but I am worried for the emergency crisis that is housing across the country, and that's what we've got going.
Thank you, Glenn McConnell. Now, not everyone can be like TVNZ's Jack Tame. They don't have 25 minutes to interview someone or days to prepare. On the internet, the deadline is always now, and that can create a rush to publish. But that doesn't mean stories should go up without basic scrutiny. It doesn't mean news organisations should just credulously accept the claims of a government press release, and it doesn't mean it should take 8 days and a completely different reporter to ask a simple question which cuts to the heart of the story.
Hayden Donnell there, looking at recent cases of our media holding powerful politicians to account, but also getting pushback at times for doing just that. Recently, Media Watch received in the post a colour-coded map of world press freedom in 2024, in which New Zealand is yellow, the colour for the category satisfactory situation, according to Reporters Without Borders. Now, New Zealand has historically been in the top 10 of its international rankings, and in this year's one, we only just made the top 20. But still, that makes New Zealand the highest-placed Asia-Pacific nation in the entire press freedom index, just one place, though, above Timor-Leste. Now, way down in 134th place was the Philippines, coloured orange for difficult situation on Reporters Without Borders' world map. And that made for some interesting conversations about press freedom at a recent East-West Centre International Media Conference, which was held in the Philippines and attended by several New Zealand journalists, including Media Watch, with the assistance of the Asia-New Zealand Foundation, Te Whitau Tūhono. Now, the Philippines Foreign Secretary Enrique Manalo told the gathering in his keynote address that press freedom there is constitutionally guaranteed and...
The Philippines truly believes the media has a key role to play. You may also rest assured that we in the Philippine government are your partners in this endeavour. Thank you.
And to be fair to him, the Philippines being cellar dwellers in the press freedom index can't be laid at the door of the current government led by the President Ferdinand Marcos Jr., but it's still a complicated situation for the media there. When the editor of the Philippine Star newspaper, Ana Marie Pamantuan, picked up an award for courage and impact in journalism at that East-West Centre media conference in Manila last month, she revealed that she was actually out on bail and facing a libel lawsuit for the 35th time at the paper that she joined as a teenager nearly 40 years ago. Ana Marie Pamantuan also hosts a news and current affairs TV talk show, and while she was putting on her makeup ahead of her live performance, she told me that this latest libel suit was a typical political effort to waste time for her and for the Star, because, as is often the case, it was filed a long way away from Manila to bump up the cost and the inconvenience.
Well, it was an allegation of corruption linking the politician and his wife, a famous actress. In the Philippines, and he filed it in his home turf. You're getting there, you have to take a plane, and then you have to drive an hour through winding mountain road. At least it was a scenic mountain road. And it's been going on for so many years.
The Philippine Secretary for Foreign Affairs, he said, the media is constitutionally protected, media freedom here in the Philippines. And his final remarks to the crowd were, you know, we are your partners, the media, in fighting misinformation. He said they have an interest in fair presentation of facts and foreign affairs and all the aspects of life.
Well, they can say that it's not systematic, that kind of harassment. Not all presidents are like Rodrigo Duterte, who shut down one of our networks. On one hand, he is telling the truth, the media is free, but there are a lot of constraints to the exercise of our profession. And whoever is in power can use their friends in business to go after media organizations through advertising boycotts, which was done by ERAP before against another newspaper. All media organizations feel that in some way, if they are friends or they want to be friends with whoever is in power, they can use it.
Do you feel entirely safe? I mean, we've heard some Philippine journalists say it's a dangerous profession and, you know, there is risk and from time to time people die.
We've had, I think we have the highest number of journalists killed in the line of duty. And this happened after the Marcos dictatorship ended. So
that's going back about 40, 35
since
years.
Since 86, since the restoration of democracy.
Is it better now for journalists? Are they less likely to suffer injury or death as a result of doing their job now than they would have been back in the 1980s or 90s?
I think it's the same. The risks are the same because the political environment is the same. Apart from politicians, you have religious groups and other influence groups. Conversely, if I can't sue you, I'll just kill you. It's easier.
So media have to have a lot of lawyers on their side. It sounds like in the Philippines.
Yes. So I think, you know, if you're going to look on the bright side, at least I just got sued, I didn't get murdered. I got an award last year, and that's what I said exactly. I was awarded Journalist of the Year.
Okay.
And that's what I told everyone. I thank you for picking a print journalist as Journalist of the Year, because everyone keeps telling me I am now a dinosaur. Journalism, as we know it as journalists, will never die. The platform will change, will evolve. We are adapting to that. We are on digital. We have a digital version. We are online. We are partnered with TV, as you can see. We are partnered with radio. That's a thing. Even AI, we are exploring it. We're studying it to find out how we can embrace the technology.
Yes, and our listeners can't see it, but you're preparing for your 4 p.m. television broadcast right now, putting on your makeup as well. So the focus is remarkable.
Yeah, it's multimedia. That's what's happening now. But unfortunately, of course, if you're a smaller media organization, it's not easy to go multimedia. You know, I was awarded for courage and impact. But you know what they say about courage? It's not the absence of fear. It's forging ahead even when what you really want to do is to run for your life. That's all I can say.
That was Anna Marie Pamantuan, editor-in-chief of the Philippine Star newspaper in Manila, where she's worked for almost 40 years. And I was speaking to her there at the newspaper's headquarters shortly after she picked up an award for courage and impact in journalism at that East-West Centre media conference in Manila. Now, also awarded the same honour that night was Tom Grundy, editor-in-chief of the Hong Kong Free Press, a non-profit online news outlet that he founded himself in the wake of the Umbrella Movement democracy protests in Hong Kong 10 years ago. Before that, Hong Kong was a major hub for the international media, but things have changed since Hong Kong became part of the People's Republic of China in 1999. Now it's all the way down at number 135 in Reporters Without Borders World Press Freedom Rankings, one place below the Philippines. Last Monday, for example, it reported that the Local Journalists Association's annual survey had recorded the lowest result for press freedom since it was first conducted in 2013. And the same day, Hong Kong Free Press reported that a Chinese journalist working for international news agency Bloomberg had been refused a visa to work at their Hong Kong bureau. She had been arrested previously by the Chinese authorities in July 2021, Hong Kong Free Press reported, on suspicion of committing crimes endangering national security. Editor-in-Chief Tom Grundy told me those same national security laws were now making journalism a lottery for Hong Kong Free Press.
Well, to paint a picture of what it was like in the before times, there was a 30-year democracy movement and a vibrant civil society. It was a city of protest, and that culminated in the 2019 protests and unrest, where patience over democracy, let alone the local police and their actions during that time, ran out. And that led us to the security laws, where, you know, nowadays you can be jailed over speech, T-shirts, a protest song. The elections have been entirely locked down now, with the opposition mostly behind bars or in self-exile. It is a shadow of its former self in terms of press freedom in what was once a bastion of free expression for the entire region. Our team of nine, after 9 years this week, have chosen to stick around. We've collectively, you know, going forward together one day at a time. In terms of words with a seditious intent, that has been used against journalists. And whether that be an interview with a wanted dissident or a simple report about an activist receiving a foreign human rights prize, those are all being considered in a case against Stand News, a digital news outlet not so different to our own, albeit more democracy-leaning, whereas we're impartial. They're about to see a verdict soon, and you're really seeing normal news reporting, in my opinion, being put on trial in many ways.
So it sounds to me like under the new security laws, is it a case that you could publish a story and really have no idea whether you've crossed a line as far as the authorities are concerned?
You say I'm familiar with them. We will go to as many workshops and speak to many legal experts and sometimes email the government for clarity as to what is allowed and what's not. And that's gives rise to self-censorship, because if you really can't get an answer from the judiciary, the Department of Justice and the police and your own lawyer as to whether it is legal to include the phrase Liberate Hong Kong, which is banned, or embed the banned song Glory to Hong Kong, which is a protest song. And I understand I can utter these things now in context, okay, in the journalistic profession. But including those in your news pieces, particularly in the earlier days, I would email and try and find out, and you'd just be told, you must obey the law, no one is above the law, you must agree to the relevant rules and regulations, etc. And lawyers would even say there's no test cases. So on matters like that and these sensitive issues, which range from ones many will be familiar with China, like Tibet, Taiwan, the Tiananmen crackdown, but these ever-moving red lines and new legislation over things like the national anthem, the flag, the emblem, the song I mentioned, the phrase I mentioned. We will never purposefully, obviously, break the law, no interest. Staff safety is first. We simply want to do our jobs and get the news out. But obviously, yes, a lot of discussions, a lot of meetings, talks to lawyers and myself, a lot of my bandwidth goes towards trying to navigate those red lines and understand what might be sensitive at the moment, which maybe wasn't 6 weeks ago or could be in 6 weeks' time. When it comes to opinion and features, we make compromises, we are selective. We're probably not going to have opinion from people based abroad, for instance, when we have to face the risk.
And there's another side of life, of course, which you do reflect in Hong Kong Free Press. One other article I happened upon on the site, Hardcore Hong Kong. Young mainland Chinese make a cross-border pilgrimage in search of underground music scene, and this is the screamo sub-emo genre, which I'm not that familiar with. But also in that, there are young people from the mainland making this trip to see the band playing in this screamo style, don't want to give their names. So
hard to get people on record, no matter what you're talking about, even if it doesn't appear to be political at all. Even the music sector, whether it's PR, academia, any private company, it would be negligent if they weren't thinking about even just their staff, what they post on social media, maybe what they're wearing. I mean, you have a supposedly world-class museum that they compare to MoMA and Tate Modern that will not bring Ai Weiwei or Tiananmen-related works out of their basement, for goodness sake. And there is obviously quite robust film censorship, and no one is going to put on an art show which is or bands which, you know, were more politically minded are not going to be speaking up anytime soon.
But what about support? You're not for profit, but you've got to stay in business. You've got, was it 8 or 9 staff? Are people prepared to keep you going, contribute financially, and make it a going concern?
I'm glad to say the willingness of Hong Kongers to pay for news is among the highest in the world, and we are sustained by almost 1,000 monthly donors to us each month, and that's practically all of our income. We're extremely transparent. We put all of our audits, incomings and outgoings, online. I reckon as the most transparent news outlet in Asia.
Militant transparency, I think you've called it.
Absolutely. So our journalistic standards, accountability, transparency. I mean, of course, we want to be the best we can, but I also want to showcase and ensure the public, the government, the donors understand what we're about, what we do, reassurances to where our money is coming from, reassurances to how it is spent. I think press freedom-wise, it's better to just have a large number of readers giving smaller amounts. I'm not accountable to any one massive tycoon or donor or anything like that. But yes, there are times where it's a pretty terrifying job for all of my team. They're more than me in that they are all locals. At the same time, it's home. And sometimes I leap out of bed because I feel this sense of duty, responsibility, obligation that probably didn't exist 4 or 5 years ago, because we're in such an important position as one of the only truly independent English language news outlet in the city.
That was Tom Grundy, founder and editor-in-chief of Hong Kong Free Press, a non-profit English language news outlet backed by its readers and donors. And it has, as you heard there, a comprehensive and public-facing editorial policy endorsed by several international standards bodies. And Tom Grundy was talking to me there at a recent international media conference called The Future of Facts, which was held in Manila, and MediaWatch attended it along with other New Zealand journalists with the assistance of the Asia New Zealand Foundation, Te Whitau Tūhono. And finally on Media Watch this weekend, last weekend, we heard how the New Zealand Herald's publisher NZME was reviewing its policy on advocacy advertising after its decision to turn the Herald's front page the previous Wednesday into a billboard for the One Law for All lobby group Hobson's Pledge and its campaign to change the Marine and Coastal Areas Act to, in Hobson's Pledge's words, restore the foreshore and seabed to public ownership. Now, predictably, that copped quite a lot of criticism. And on last Monday's edition of the daily podcast The Detail, newsroom co-editor and former Herald editor Tim Murphy said the decision to run that initial ad would have come over the head of his successor from the very top at NZME.
The people who run the actual business, this chief executive and the head of publishing, who sit above both the advertising and the editorial or the editor, are the people who would make the big decisions.
Ultimately, the buck stops with the CEO and the head of publishing there. Is that correct?
Yeah, that would be the case. And my pick, I haven't spoken to my successor. I was editor at the Herald for 14 years, but I haven't spoken directly to my successor or other editors directly. I don't think that would be fair on them. What I can say is that I would be very surprised if the editorial part of the Herald, the journalists, the editor, hadn't raised questions about running the Hobson's Pledge advertisement on the front page in the form it's in.
But as we heard last Wednesday on Midweek Media Watch, Hobson's Pledge had another full-page ad ready to go in the Herald, hitting back at its critics last week. But in the end, that didn't appear. The same day, though, Hobson's Pledge leader Don Brash appeared on the platform, and he said he'd had this explanation from the Herald.
And what she says is, after careful consideration and the light of feedback we've received from our subscribers and our team, NZME has decided not to proceed with running the advertisement. We understand this might be disappointing news, and I want to assure you that this decision was not made lightly.
And at the end of that interview, Dr. Brash said this.
They've been reluctant to take ads from us before, so we were kind of agreeably surprised they took the double-page ad last week. And we thought, hey, the Herald has suddenly turned over a new leaf and seen the light, so to speak. But that may not be the case.
It seems not. And Don Brash wasn't the only one perturbed by this latest knockback from the Herald. The Taxpayers Union also pays to put its own campaigning ads in papers. And when it tested the waters after the Hobson's Pledge controversy, Jordan Williams, its executive director, told Taxpayers Union supporters they were also told by the Herald the policy on advocacy advertising is under review. Well, Jordan Williams also aired his grievances about that on the platform last Monday, telling the host Sean Plunkett they'd asked for a meeting with the Herald about this, but received no invitation by that time. And getting a meeting might be an uphill battle if the Herald was listening to the platform last Monday, when Jordan Williams told the host Sean Plunkett NZME was a pathetic commercial organisation that had been influenced by what he called a few wokesters jumping up and down about Hobson's Pledge. And he said this about that change in ad policy.
Well, I understand it's actually there's some of the sort of millennial staff, but I understand the real problem is the chair. They've got quite a...
Barbara.
The name escapes me.
She is also the patron of the Rainbow Tech organisation, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, look, I've had a couple of major donors reach out to me and tell me that NZME have quite a weak chair. And I think that's possibly where this is coming from.
Well, the name of the NZME chair that they couldn't recall there is Barbara Chapman, who's also the chair of Genesis Energy, as well as being a patron of the Rainbow Tick Excellence Awards for Diversity in Business, as they mentioned there. And she's also a deputy chair of the New Zealand Initiative think tank. And if the Taxpayers Union do want to build a client relationship with NZME for advocacy advertising at a time when that's become controversial, well, broadcasting hearsay from their donors about the supposed weakness of the key governor of NZME is possibly not the normal way to do it. That's all from Media Watch for this weekend. Thanks for listening. Hayden will be back with Midweek Media Watch next Wednesday. And then we'll be back again with Media Watch as usual next weekend. Follow Media Watch and listen on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any podcast app to make sure you never miss an episode. And if you have any thoughts to share with us or ideas for us to follow up, do get in touch. You can email us, mediawatch@rnz.co.nz, and you'll also find us at MediaWatchNZ on X. And you can even write us an old-fashioned letter and send it to PO Box 123, Wellington. That's all from us for now. Ka kite. Catch you again for Midweek Media Watch next Wednesday night.